7. Hodges told Holly he intended to spend at least part of his weekend crashed out in his Lazy Boy watching baseball, and on Sunday afternoon he does watch the first 3 innings of the Indians game. But then a certain restlessness takes hold, and he decides to pay a call. Not on an old pal, but certainly an old acquaintance. After each of these visits, he tells himself, okay, that's the end. This is pointless. He means it, too. Then, 4 weeks later, or 8, maybe 10, he'll take the ride again. Something nags him into it. Besides, the Indians are already down to the Rangers by 5, and it's only the 3rd inning. He zaps off the television, pulls on an old Police Athletic League t-shirt. In his heavyset days, he used to steer clear of tees, but now he likes the way they fall straight with hardly any belly swell above the waist of his pants, and locks up the house. Traffic is light on Sunday, and 20 minutes later he's sliding his Prius into a slot on the 3rd deck of the visitor's parking garage, adjacent to the vast and ever-metastasizing concrete sprawl of John M. Kiner Hospital. As he walks to the parking garage elevator, he sends up a prayer, as he almost always does, thanking God that he's here as a visitor rather than as a paying customer. All too aware, even as he says this very proper thank you, that most people become customers sooner or later, here or at one of the city's 4 other fine and not-so-fine sick bays. No one rides for free, and in the end, even the most seaworthy ship goes down, blub, blub, blub. The only way to balance that off, in Hodges' opinion, is to make the most of every day afloat. But if that's true, what is he doing here? The thought recalls to mind a snatch of poetry, heard or read long ago and lodged in his brain by virtue of its simple rhyme. Oh, do not ask what is it, let us go and make our visit. 8. It's easy to get lost in any big city hospital, but Hodges has made this trip plenty of times, and these days he's more apt to give directions than ask for them. The garage elevator takes him down to a covered walkway. The walkway takes him to a lobby the size of a train terminal. The corridor A elevator takes him up to the 3rd floor. A skyway takes him across Kiner Boulevard to his final destination, where the walls are painted a soothing pink and the atmosphere is hushed. The sign above the reception desk reads, "Welcome to Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic. No cell phones or telecommunications devices allowed. Help us maintain a quiet environment. We appreciate your cooperation." Hodges goes to the desk where his visitor's badge is already waiting. The head nurse knows him. After 4 years, they are almost old friends. "How's your family, Becky?" She says they are fine. "Son's broken arm mending?" She says it is. "The cast is off, and he'll be out of the sling in another week, 2 at most." "That's fine. Is my boy in his room or physical therapy?" She says he's in his room. Hodges ambles down the hall toward room 217, where a certain patient resides at state expense. Before Hodges gets there, he meets the orderly the nurses call Library Al. He's in his 60s, and, as usual, he's pushing a trolley cart packed with paperbacks and newspapers. These days there's a new addition to his little arsenal of diversions, a small plastic tub filled with handheld e-readers. "Hey, Al," Hodges says, "how you doing?" Although Al is ordinarily garrulous, this afternoon he seems half asleep, and there are purple circles under his eyes. Somebody had a hard night, Hodges thinks with amusement. He knows the symptoms, having had a few hard ones himself. He thinks of snapping his fingers in front of Al's eyes, sort of like a stage hypnotist, then decides that would be mean. Let the man suffer the tail end of his hangover in peace. If it's this bad in the afternoon, Hodges hates to think of what it must have been like this morning. But Al comes to and smiles before Hodges can pass by.
"Hey there, detective. Haven't seen your face in the place for a while."
"It's just plain old mister these days, Al. You feeling okay?"
"Sure, just thinking about..."
Al shrugs.
"Geez, I don't know what I was thinking about."
He laughs.
"Getting old is no job for sissies."
"You're not old," Hodges says. "Somebody forgot to give you the news. 60 is a new 40. Al snorts.
"Ain't that a crock of you know what?"
Hodges couldn't agree more. He points to the cart. Don't suppose my boy ever asks for a book, does he? Al gives another snort.
Hartsfield? He couldn't read a Berenstain Bears book these days.
He taps his forehead gravely.
Nothing left but oatmeal up top. Although sometimes he does hold out his hand for one of these.
He picks up a Zap-It e-reader. It's a bright, girly pink.
These jobbies have games on them.
He plays games? Hodges is astounded.
Oh, God, no. His motor control is shot. But if I turn on one of the demos, like Barbie Fashion Walk or Fishing Hole, he stares at it for hours. The demos do the same thing over and over, but does he know that?
I'm guessing not.
Good guess. I think he likes the noises, too, the beeps and boops and goinks. I come back 2 hours later, the reader's laying on his bed or windowsill, screen dark, battery flat as a pancake. But what the hell, that don't hurt him. 3 hours on the charger and they're ready to go again. He don't recharge, though. Probably a good thing.
Al wrinkles his nose. Is it a bad smell? Maybe, maybe not, Hodges thinks. As long as he's not better, he's here, in a nice hospital room. Not much of a view, but there's air conditioning, color TV, and every now and then a bright pink Zap-It to stare at. If he was compos mentis, able to assist in his own defense, as the law has it, he'd have to stand trial for a dozen offenses, including 9 counts of murder. 10, if the DA decided to add in the asshole's mother who died of poisoning. Then it would be Waynesville State Prison for the rest of his life. No air conditioning there. Take it easy, Al. You look tired.
Nah, I'm fine, Detective Hutchinson. Enjoy your visit.
Al rolls on and Hodges looks after him, brow furrowed. Hutchinson? Where the hell did that come from? Hodges has been coming here for years now, and Al knows his name perfectly well. Or did? Jesus, he hopes the guy isn't suffering from early-onset dementia. For the first 4 months or so, there were 2 guards on the door of 217. Then 1. Now there are none, because guarding Brady is a waste of time and money. There's not much danger of escape when the perp can't even make it to the bathroom by himself. Each year, there's talk of transferring him to a cheaper institution upstate, and each year, the prosecutor reminds all and sundry that this gentleman, brain-damaged or not, is technically still awaiting trial. It's easy to keep him here because the clinic foots a large portion of the bills. The neurological team, especially Dr. Felix Babineau, the head of department, finds Brady Hartsfield an extremely interesting case. This afternoon, he sits by the window, dressed in jeans and a checked shirt. His hair is long and needs cutting, but it's been washed and shines golden in the sunlight. Hair some girl would love to run her fingers through, Hodges thinks, if she didn't know what a monster he was. Hello, Brady. Hartsfield doesn't stir. He's looking out the window, yes, but is he seeing the brick wall of the parking garage, which is his only view? Does he know it's Hodges in the room with him? Does he know anybody is in the room with him? These are questions to which a whole team of neuro guys would like answers. So would Hodges, who sits on the end of the bed thinking, was a monster, or still is? Long time no see, as the landlocked sailor said to the chorus girl. Hartsfield makes no reply. I know. That's an oldie. I got hundreds, ask my daughter. How are you feeling? Hartsfield makes no reply. His hands are in his lap, the long white fingers loosely clasped. In April of 2009, Brady Hartsfield stole a Mercedes-Benz belonging to Holly's aunt and deliberately drove at high speed into a crowd of job seekers at City Center. He killed 8 and seriously injured 12, including Thomas Saubers, father of Peter and Tina. He got away with it, too. Hartsfield's mistake was to write Hodges, by then retired, a taunting letter. The following year, Brady killed Holly's cousin, a woman with whom Hodges had been falling in love. Fittingly, it was Holly herself who stopped Brady Hartsfield's clock, almost literally bashing his brains out with Hodge's own happy slapper before Hartsfield could detonate a bomb that would have killed thousands of kids at a pop concert. The first blow from the slapper had fractured Hartsfield's skull, but it was the second one that did what was considered to be irreparable damage. He was admitted to the traumatic brain injury clinic in a deep coma from which he was unlikely to ever emerge. So said Dr. Babineau. But on a dark and stormy night in November of 2011, Hartsfield opened his eyes and spoke to the nurse changing his IV bag. When considering that moment, Hodges always imagines Dr. Frankenstein screaming, "It's alive, it's alive." Hartsfield said he had a headache and asked for his mother. When Dr. Babineau was fetched and asked his patient to follow his finger to check his extraocular movements, Hartsfield was able to do so. Over the 30 months since then, Brady Hartsfield has spoken on many occasions, although never to Hodges. Mostly he asks for his mother. When he's told she is dead, he sometimes nods as if he understands. But then, a day or a week later, he'll repeat the request. He is able to follow simple instructions in the PT center and can sort of walk again, although it's actually more of an orderly assisted shamble. On good days, he's able to feed himself but cannot dress himself. He is classed as a semi-catatonic. Mostly he sits in his room, either looking out the window at the parking garage or at a picture of flowers on the wall of his room. But there have been certain peculiar occurrences around Brady Hartsfield over the last year or so, and as a result, he has become something of a legend in the brain injury clinic. There are rumors and speculations. Dr. Babineau scoffs at these and refuses to talk about them. But some of the orderlies and other nurses will, and a certain retired police detective has proved to be an avid listener over the years. Hodges leans forward, hands dangling between his knees, and smiles at Hartsfield. "Are you faking, Brady?" Brady makes no reply. "Why bother? You're going to be locked up for the rest of your life one way or the other." Brady makes no reply, but one hand rises slowly from his lap. He almost pokes himself in the eye, then gets what he was aiming for and brushes a lock of hair from his forehead. "Want to ask about your mother?" Brady makes no reply. "She's dead, rotting in her coffin. You fed her a bunch of gopher poison. She must have died hard. Did she die hard? Were you there? Did you watch?" No reply. "Are you in there, Brady? Knock, knock. Hello?" No reply. "I think you are. I hope you are. Hey, tell you something. I used to be a big drinker, and you know what I remember best about those days?" Nothing. "The hangovers. Struggling to get out of bed with my head pounding like a hammer on an anvil. Pissing the morning quart and wondering what I did the night before. Sometimes not even knowing how I got home. Checking my car for dents. It was like being lost inside my own fucking mind, looking for the door so I could get out of there and not finding it until maybe noon when things would finally start going back to normal." This makes him think briefly of Library Al. "I hope that's where you are right now, Brady. Wandering around inside your half-busted brain and looking for a way out. Only for you, there isn't one. For you, the hangover just goes on and on. Is that how it is? Man, I hope so." His hands hurt. He looks down at them and sees his fingernails digging into his palms. He lets up and watches the white crescents there fill in red. He refreshes his smile. "Just saying, buddy. Just saying. You want to say anything back?" Hartsfield says nothing back. Hodges stands up. "That's all right. You sit right there by the window and try to find that way out. The one that isn't there. While you do that, I'll go outside and breathe some fresh air. It's a beautiful day." On the table between the chair and the bed is a photograph Hodges first saw in the house on Elm Street where Hartsfield lived with his mother. This is a smaller version in a plain silver frame. It shows Brady and his mom on a beach somewhere, arms around each other, cheeks pressed together, looking more like boyfriend and girlfriend than mother and son. As Hodges turns to go, the picture falls over with a toneless clack sound. He looks at it, looks at Hartsfield, then looks back at the face-down picture. Brady? No answer. There never is. Not to him, anyway. Brady, did you do that? Nothing. Brady is staring down at his lap where his fingers are once more loosely entwined. Some of the nurses say... Hodges doesn't finish the thought. He sets the picture back up on its little stand. If you did it, do it again. Nothing from Hartsfield, and nothing from the picture. Mother and son in happier days. Deborah Ann Hartsfield and her honey boy. All right, Brady. See you later, alligator. Leaving the scene, Jellybean. He does so, closing the door behind him. As he does, Brady Hartsfield looks up briefly and smiles. On the table, the picture falls over again. Clack. 9. Ellen Bran, known as Bran Stoker by students who have taken the Northfield High English Department's fantasy and horror class, is standing by the door of a school bus parked in the Riverbend Resort reception area. Her cell phone is in her hand. It's 4 p.m. on Sunday afternoon, and she's about to call 911 to report a missing student. That's when Peter Saubers comes around the restaurant side of the building, running so fast that his hair flies back from his forehead. Ellen is unfailingly correct with her students, always staying on the teacher's side of the line and never trying to buddy up, but on this one occasion, she casts propriety aside and enfolds Pete in a hug so strong and frantic that it nearly stops his breath. From the bus, where the other NHS class officers and officers-to-be are waiting, there comes a sarcastic smatter of applause. Ellen lets up on the hug, grabs his shoulders, and does another thing she's never done to a student before. Gives him a good shaking. Where were you? You missed all 3 morning seminars. You missed lunch. I was on the verge of calling the police. I'm sorry, Ms. Bran. I was sick to my stomach. I thought the fresh air would help me. Ms. Bran, chaperone and advisor on this weekend trip because she teaches American politics as well as American history, decides she believes him. Not just because Pete is one of her best students and has never caused her trouble before, but because the boy looks sick. Well, you should have informed me, she says. I thought you'd taken it into your head to hitchhike back to town or something. If anything had happened to you, I'd be blamed. Don't you realize you kids are my responsibility when we're on a class trip? I lost track of the time. I was vomiting, and I didn't want to do it inside. It must have been something I ate. Or one of those 24-hour bugs. It wasn't anything he ate, and he doesn't have a bug, but the vomiting part is true enough. It's nerves. Unadulterated fright, to be more exact. He's terrified about facing Andrew Halliday tomorrow. It could go right. He knows there's a chance for it to go right, but it will be like threading a moving needle. If it goes wrong, he'll be in trouble with his parents and in trouble with the police. College scholarships, need-based or otherwise, forget them. He might even go to jail. So he has spent the day wandering the paths that crisscross the 30 acres of resort property, going over the coming confrontation again and again. What he will say, what Halliday will say, what he will say in return, and yes, he lost track of time. Pete wishes he had never seen that fucking trunk. He thinks, but I was only trying to do the right thing. God damn it, that's all I was trying to do. Ellen sees the tears standing in the boy's eyes and notices for the first time, perhaps because he shaved off that silly singles bar mustache, how thin his face has become. Really just half a step from gaunt. She drops her cell back into her purse and comes out with a packet of tissues. Wipe your face, she says. A voice from the bus calls out, Hey, Saubers, did you get any? Shut up, Jeremy, Ellen says without turning, then to Pete. I should give you a week's detention for this little stunt, but I'm going to cut you some slack. Indeed she is, because a week's detention would necessitate an oral report to NHS Assistant Principal Waters, who is also school disciplinarian. Waters would inquire into her own actions and would want to know why she had not sounded the alarm earlier, especially if she were forced to admit that she hadn't actually seen Pete Sauber since dinner in the restaurant the night before. He had been out of her sight and supervision for nearly a full day, and that was far too long for a school-mandated trip.
Thank you, Miss Bran. Do you think you're done throwing up?
Yes, there's nothing left.
Then get on the bus and let's go home.
There's more sarcastic applause as Pete comes up the steps and makes his way down the aisle. He tries to smile, as if everything is okay. All he wants is to get back to Sycamore Street and hide in his room, waiting for tomorrow so he can get this nightmare over with. 10. When Hodges gets home from the hospital, a good-looking young man in a Harvard T-shirt is sitting on his stoop, reading a thick paperback with a bunch of fighting Greeks or Romans on the cover. Sitting beside him is an Irish setter wearing the sort of happy-go-lucky grin that seems to be the default expression of dogs raised in friendly homes. Both man and dog rise when Hodges pulls into the little lean-to that serves as his garage. The young man meets him halfway across the lawn, one-fisted hand held out. Hodges bumps knuckles with him, thus acknowledging Jerome's blackness, then shakes his hand, thereby acknowledging his own waspiness. Jerome stands back, holding Hodges' forearms and giving him a once-over.
"Look at you," he exclaims, "skinny as ever was."
"I walk," Hodges says, "and I bought a treadmill for rainy days."
"Excellent. You'll live forever."
"I wish," Hodges says and bends down. The dog extends a paw and Hodges shakes it. "How you doing, Odell?" Odell woofs, which presumably means he's doing fine. "Come on in," Hodges says. "I have Cokes, unless you'd prefer a beer."
"Coke's fine. I bet Odell would appreciate some water. We walked over. Odell doesn't walk as fast as he used to."
His bowl's still under the sink. They go in and toast each other with icy glasses of Coca-Cola. Odell laps water, then stretches out in his accustomed place beside the TV. Hodges was an obsessive television watcher during the first months of his retirement, but now the box rarely goes on except for Scott Pelley on the CBS Evening News or the occasional Indians game.
"How's the pacemaker, Bill?"
"I don't even know it's there, which is just the way I like it. What happened to the big country club dance you were going to in Pittsburgh with what's-her-name?"
"That didn't work out. As far as my parents are concerned, what's-her-name and I discovered that we are not compatible in terms of our academic and personal interests."
Hodges raises his eyebrows. Sounds a tad lawyerly for a philosophy major with a minor in ancient cultures. Jerome sips his Coke, sprawls his long legs out, and grins.
"Truth? What's-her-name, a.k.a. Priscilla, was using me to tweak the jealous bone of her high school boyfriend. And it worked. Told me how sorry she was to get me down there on false pretenses. Hopes we can still be friends, so on and so forth. A little embarrassing, but probably all for the best." He pauses. "She still has all her Barbies and brats on a shelf in her room. And I must admit that gave me pause. I guess I wouldn't mind too much if my folks found out I was the stick she stirred her pot of love soup with, but if you tell the Barbster, I'll never hear the end of it."
"Mum's the word," Hodges says. "So what now? Back to Massachusetts?"
"Nope, I'm here for the summer. Got a job down on the docks swinging containers."
"That is not work for a Harvard man, Jerome."
"It is for this one. I got my heavy equipment license last winter. The pay is excellent, and Harvard ain't cheap, even with a partial scholarship."
Tyrone Feelgood Delight makes a mercifully brief guest appearance.
"Dis here black boy going tote that barge and lift that bale, Massa Hodges."
Then back to Jerome, just like that.
"Who's mowing your lawn? It looks pretty good."
"Not Jerome Robinson quality, but pretty good." "Kid from the end of the block," Hodges says. "Is this just a courtesy call, or—"
"Barbara and her friend Tina told me one hell of a story," Jerome says. "Tina was reluctant to spill it at first, but Barb's talked her into it. She's good at stuff like that. Listen, you know Tina's father was hurt in the city center thing, right?"
"Yes."
"If her big brother was really the one sending cash to keep the fam afloat, good for him. But where did it come from?"
I can't figure that one out no matter how hard I try.
Nor can I.
Tina says you're going to ask him.
After school tomorrow is the plan.
Is Holly involved?
To an extent. She's doing background.
Cool. Jerome grins big. How about I come with you tomorrow? Get the band back together, man. Play all the hits.
Hodges considers. I don't know, Jerome. One guy, a golden oldie like me, might not upset young Mr. Salbers too much. Two guys, though, especially when one of them's a badass black dude who stands 6'4".
15 rounds, and I'm still pretty, Jerome proclaims, waving clasped hands over his head. Odell lays back his ears. Still pretty. That bad old bear Sonny Liston never touched me. I float like a butterfly. I sting like a...
He assesses Hodges' patient expression. Okay, sorry, sometimes I get carried away. Where are you going to wait for him?
Out front was the plan. You know, where the kids actually exit the building.
Not all of them come out that way, and he might not, especially if Tina lets on she talked to you.
He sees Hodges about to speak and raises a hand.
She says she won't, but big brothers know little sisters. You can take that from a guy who's got one. If he knows somebody wants to ask him questions, he's apt to go out the back and cut across the football field to Westfield Street. I could park there, give you a call if I see him.
Do you know what he looks like?
Uh-huh. Tina had a picture in her wallet. Let me be a part of this, Bill. Barbie likes that chick. I liked her, too. And it took guts for her to come to you, even with my sister snapping the whip.
I know.
Also, I'm curious as hell. Tina says the money started coming when her bro was only 13. A kid that young with access to that much money.
Jerome shakes his head.
I'm not surprised he's in trouble.
Me either. I guess if you want to be in, you're in.
My man!
This cry necessitates another fist bump. You went to Northfield, Jerome. Is there any other way he could go out besides the front in Westfield Street? Jerome thinks it over.
If he went down to the basement, there's a door that takes you out to one side where the smoking area used to be back in the day. I guess he could go across that, then cut through the auditorium and come out on Garner Street.
I could put Holly there, Hodges says thoughtfully.
Excellent idea, Jerome cries. Getting the band back together, what I said.
But no approach if you see him, Hodges says. Just call. I get to approach. I'll tell Holly the same thing. Not that she'd be likely to.
As long as we get to hear the story.
If I get it, you'll get it, Hodges says, hoping he has not just made a rash promise. Come by my office in the Turner Building around 2 and we'll move out around 2:15. Be in position by 2:45.
You're sure Holly will be okay with this?
Yes, she's fine with watching. It's confrontation that gives her problems.
Not always.
No, Hodges says, not always.
They are both thinking of one confrontation, at the Mac with Brady Hartsfield. That Holly handled just fine.
Jerome glances at his watch.
I have to go. Promised I'd take the Barbster to the mall. She wants a swatch.
He rolls his eyes. Hodges grins. I love your sis, Jerome.
Jerome grins back. Actually, so do I. Come on, Odell, let's shuffle.
Odell rises and heads for the door. Jerome grasps the knob, then turns back. His grin is gone.
Have you been where I think you've been?
Probably.
Does Holly know you visit him?
No, and you're not to tell her. She'd find it vastly upsetting.
Yes, she would. How is he?
The same. Although, Hodges is thinking of how the picture fell over. That clack sound.
Although what?
Nothing. He's the same. Do me one favor, okay? Tell Barbara to get in touch if Tina calls and says her brother found out the girls talked to me on Friday.
Will do. See you tomorrow.
Jerome leaves. Hodges turns on the TV and is delighted to see the Indians are still on. They've tied it up. The game is going into extra innings.
11. Holly spends Sunday evening in her apartment, trying to watch The Godfather Part 2 on her computer. Usually this would be a very pleasant occupation, because she considers it one of the two or three best movies ever made, right up there with Citizen Kane and Paths of Glory. But tonight,
She keeps pausing it so she can pace worry circles around the living room of her apartment. There's a lot of room to pace. This apartment isn't as glitzy as the lakeside condo she lived in for a while when she first moved to the city, but it's in a good neighborhood and plenty big. She can afford the rent. Under the terms of her cousin Janie's will, Holly inherited $500,000. Less after taxes, of course, but still a very nice nest egg. And thanks to her job with Bill Hodges, she can afford to let the nest egg grow. As she paces, she mutters some of her favorite lines from the movie. I don't have to wipe everyone out, just my enemies. How do you say banana daiquiri? Your country ain't your blood, remember that. And of course, the one everyone remembers. I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. If she was watching another movie, she would be incanting a different set of quotes. It is a form of self-hypnosis that she has practiced ever since she saw The Sound of Music at the age of 7. Favorite line from that one, I wonder what grass tastes like. She's really thinking about the Moleskine notebook Tina's brother was so quick to hide under his pillow. Bill believes it has nothing to do with the money Pete was sending his parents, but Holly isn't so sure. She has kept journals for most of her life, listing all the movies she's seen, all the books she's read, the people she's talked to, the time she gets up, the time she goes to bed. Also her bowel movements, which are coded, after all someone may see her journals after she's dead, as WP, which stands for went potty. She knows this is OCD behavior. She and her therapist have discussed how obsessive listing is really just another form of magical thinking, but it doesn't hurt anyone. And if she prefers to keep her lists in Moleskine notebooks, whose business is that besides her own? The point is, she knows from Moleskines, and therefore knows they're not cheap. $2.50 will get you a spiral-bound notebook in Walgreens, but a Moleskine with the same number of pages goes for $10. Why would a kid want such an expensive notebook, especially when he came from a cash-strapped family? Doesn't make sense, Holly says. Then, as if just following this train of thought, leave the gun, take the cannoli. That's from the original Godfather, but it's still a good line, one of the best. Send the money, keep the notebook. An expensive notebook that got shoved under the pillow when the little sister appeared unexpectedly in the room. The more Holly thinks about it, the more she thinks there might be something there. She restarts the movie, but can't follow its well-worn and well-loved path with this notebook stuff rolling around in her head, so Holly does something almost unheard of, at least before bedtime. She turns her computer off. Then she resumes pacing, hands locked together at the small of her back. Send the money, keep the notebook. And the lag, she exclaims to the empty room. Don't forget that. Yes, the 7 months of quiet time, between when the money ran out and when the Saubers boy started to get his underpants all in a twist. Because it took him 7 months to think up a way to get more money? Holly thinks yes. Holly thinks he got an idea, but it wasn't a good idea. It was an idea that got him in trouble. What gets people in trouble when it's about money? Holly asks the empty room, pacing faster than ever. Stealing does. So does blackmail. Was that it? Did Pete Saubers try to blackmail somebody about something in the Moleskine notebook? Something about the stolen money, maybe? Only how could Pete blackmail someone about that money when he must have stolen it himself? Holly goes to the telephone, reaches for it, then pulls her hand back. For almost a minute, she just stands there, gnawing her lips. She's not used to taking the initiative in things. Maybe she should call Bill first and ask him if it's okay. Bill doesn't think the notebook's important, though, she tells her living room. I think different, and I can think different if I want to. She snatches herself from the coffee table and calls Tina Saubers before she can lose her nerve. Hello? Tina asks cautiously, almost whispering. Who's this? Holly Gibney. You didn't see my number come up because it's unlisted. I'm very careful about my number, although I'll be happy to give it to you if you want. We can talk any time, because we're friends, and that's what friends do. Is your brother back home from his weekend?
Yes. He came in around 6 while we were finishing up dinner. Mom said there was still plenty of pot roast and potatoes. She'd heat them up if he wanted, but he said they stopped at Denny's on the way back. Then he went up to his room. He didn't even want any strawberry shortcake, and he loves that. I'm really worried about him, Miss Holly.
You can just call me Holly, Tina. She hates Miz. Thinks it sounds like a mosquito buzzing around your head.
Okay.
Did he say anything to you?
Just hi, Tina says in a small voice.
And you didn't tell him about coming to the office with Barbara on Friday?
God, no! Where is he now?
Still in his room, listening to the Black Keys. I hate the Black Keys. Yes, me too. Holly has no idea who the Black Keys are, although she could name the entire cast of Fargo. Best line in that one, delivered by Steve Buscemi, smoke a fucking peace pipe. Tina, does Pete have a special friend he might have talked to about what's bothering him? Tina thinks it over. Holly takes the opportunity to snatch a Nicorette from the open pack beside her computer and pop it into her mouth.
I don't think so, Tina says at last. I guess he has friends at school. He's pretty popular. But his only close friend was Bob Pearson from down the block. And they moved to Denver last year.
What about a girlfriend?
He used to spend a lot of time with Gloria Moore, but they broke up after Christmas. Pete said she didn't like to read, and he could never get tight with a girl who didn't like books.
Wistfully, Tina adds,
I like Gloria. She showed me how to do my eyes.
Girls don't need eye makeup until they're in their 30s, Holly says authoritatively, although she has never actually worn any herself. Her mother says only sluts wear eye makeup.
Really?
Tina sounds astonished.
What about teachers? Did he have a favorite teacher he might have talked to?
Holly doubts if an older brother would have talked to his kid sister about favorite teachers, or if the kid sister would have paid any attention if he did. She asks because it's the only other thing she can think of. But Tina doesn't even hesitate.
Ricky the hippie,
she says and giggles. Holly stops in mid-pace.
Who? Mr. Ricker, that's his real name.
Pete said some of the kids call him Ricky the Hippie because he wears these old-time flower power shirts and ties. Pete had him when he was a freshman, or maybe a sophomore. I can't remember.
He said Mr. Ricker knew what good books were all about. Holly? Is Mr. Hodges still going to talk to Pete tomorrow?
Yes, don't worry about that. But Tina is plenty worried. She sounds on the verge of tears, in fact. And this makes Holly's stomach contract into a tight little ball.
Oh, boy, I hope he doesn't hate me.
He won't, Holly says. She's chewing her Nicorette at warp speed. Bill will find out what's wrong and fix it. Then your brother will love you more than ever.
Do you promise?
Yes.
Ouch! What's wrong?
Nothing. She wipes her mouth and looks at a smear of blood on her fingers. I bit my lip. I have to go, Tina. Will you call me if you think of anyone he might have talked to about the money?
There's no one, Tina says forlornly and starts to cry.
Well, okay. And because something else seems required, don't bother with eye makeup. Your eyes are very pretty as they are. Goodbye. She ends the call without waiting for Tina to say anything else and resumes pacing. She spits the wad of Nicorette into the wastebasket by her desk and blots her lip with a tissue, but the bleeding has already stopped. No close friends, and no steady girl. No names except for that one teacher. Holly sits down and powers up her computer again. She opens Firefox, goes to the Northfield High website, clicks Our Faculty, and there is Howard Ricker, wearing a flower-patterned shirt with billowy sleeves, just like Tina said. Also a very ridiculous tie. Is it really so impossible that Pete Saubers said something to his favorite English teacher? Especially if it had to do with whatever he was writing or reading in a moleskin notebook? A few clicks and she has Howard Ricker's telephone number on her computer screen. It's still early, but she can't bring herself to cold call a complete stranger. Phoning Tina was hard enough, and that call ended in tears. I'll tell Bill tomorrow, she decides. He can call Ricky the hippie if he thinks it's worth doing. She goes back to her voluminous movie folder and is soon once more lost in The Godfather, Part 2. 12. Morris visits another computer cafe that Sunday night and does his own quick bit of research. When he's found what he wants, he fishes out the piece of notepaper with Peter Sauber's cell number on it and jots down Andrew Halliday's address. Coleridge Street is on the west side. In the 70s, that was a middle-class and mostly white enclave, where all the houses tried to look a little more expensive than they actually were, and as a result, all ended up looking pretty much the same. A quick visit to several local real estate sites shows Morris that things over there haven't changed much, although an upscale shopping center has been added, Valley Plaza. Andy's car may still be parked at his house out there. Of course, it might be in a space behind his shop. Morris never checked. Christ, you can't check everything, he thinks. But that seems unlikely. Why would you put up with the hassle of driving 3 miles into the city every morning and 3 miles back every night in rush hour traffic when you could buy a 30-day bus pass for $10 or a 6 months pass for $50? Morris has the keys to his old pal's house, although he'd never try using them. The house is a lot more likely to be alarmed than the Birch Street wreck. But he also has the keys to Andy's car, and a car might come in handy. He walks back to Bugshit Manor, convinced that McFarlane will be waiting for him there, and not content just to make Morris pee in the little cup. No, not this time. This time, he'll also want to toss his room, and when he does, he'll find the tough tote with the stolen computer and the bloody shirt and shoes inside, not to mention the envelope of money he took from his old pal's desk. I'd kill him, thinks Morris, who is now, in his own mind at least, Morris the Wolf. Only he couldn't use the gun. Plenty of people in Bugshit Manor know what a gunshot sounds like. Even a polite kapow from a little faggot gun like his old pal's P-238. And he left the hatchet in Andy's office. That might not do the job even if he did have it. McFarlane is big, like Andy, but not all puddly fat like Andy. McFarlane looks strong. That's okay, Morris tells himself. That shit don't mean shit. Because an old wolf is a crafty wolf, and that's what I have to be now. Crafty. McFarlane isn't waiting on the stoop, but before Morris can breathe a sigh of relief, he becomes convinced that his P.O. will be waiting for him upstairs. Not in the hall, either. He's probably got a pass key that lets him into every room in this fucked-up, piss-smelling place. Try me, he thinks. You just try me, you son of a bitch. But the door is locked. The room is empty. And it doesn't look like it's been searched, although he supposes if McFarlane did it carefully, craftily. But then Morris calls himself an idiot. If McFarland had searched his room, he would have been waiting with a couple of cops, and the cops would have handcuffs. Nevertheless, he snatches open the closet door to make sure the tough totes are where he left them. They are. He takes out the money and counts it. $640. Not great. Not even close to what was in Rothstein's safe. But not bad. He puts it back, zips the bag shut, then sits on his bed and holds up his hands. They are shaking. I have to get that stuff out of here, he thinks, and I have to do it tomorrow morning. But get it out to where? Morris lies down on his bed and looks up at the ceiling, thinking. At last he falls asleep. 13. Monday dawns clear and warm. The thermometer in front of City Center reading 70 before the sun is even fully over the horizon. School is still in session and will be for the next 2 weeks, but today is going to be the first real sizzler of the summer, the kind of day that makes people wipe the backs of their necks and squint at the sun and talk about global warming. When Hodges gets to his office at 8:30, Holly is already there. She tells him about her conversation with Tina last night and asks if Hodges will talk to Howard Ricker
a.k.a. Ricky the Hippie, if he can't get the story of the money from Pete himself. Hodges agrees to this and tells Holly that was good thinking. She glows at this, but privately believes talking to Ricker won't be necessary. If he can't crack a 17-year-old kid, one who's probably dying, to tell someone what's been weighing him down, he needs to quit working and move to Florida, home of so many retired cops. He asks Holly if she'll watch for the Saubers boy on Garner Street when school lets out this afternoon. She agrees, as long as she doesn't have to talk to him herself. "You won't," Hodges assures her. "If you see him, all you need to do is call me. I'll come around the block and cut him off. Have we got pics of him?"
"I've downloaded half a dozen to my computer. 5 from the yearbook and 1 from the Garner Street Library, where he works as a student aide or something. Come and look."
The best photo, a portrait shot in which Pete Saubers is wearing a tie and a dark sport coat, identifies him as Class of 15 Student Vice President. He's dark-haired and good-looking. The resemblance to his kid sister isn't striking, but it's there all right. Intelligent blue eyes look levelly out at Hodges. In them is the faintest glint of humor. "Can you email these to Jerome?"
"Already done."
Holly smiles, and Hodges thinks, as he always does, that she should do it more often. When she smiles, Holly is almost beautiful. With a little mascara around her eyes, she probably would be.
"Gee, it'll be good to see Jerome again."
"What have I got this morning, Holly? Anything?"
"Court at 10 o'clock. The assault thing."
"Oh, right. The guy who tuned up on his brother-in-law. Belson the Bald Beater."
"It's not nice to call people names," Holly says.
This is probably true, but court is always an annoyance, and having to go there today is particularly trying, even though it will probably take no more than an hour unless Judge Wiggins has slowed down since Hodges was on the cops. Pete Huntley used to call Brenda Wiggins FedEx because she always delivered on time. The Bald Beater is James Belson, whose picture should probably be next to white trash in the dictionary. He's a resident of the city's Edgemont Avenue district, sometimes referred to as Hillbilly Heaven. As part of his contract with one of the city's car dealerships, Hodges was hired to repo Belson's Acura MDX, on which Belson had ceased making payments some months before. When Hodges arrived at Belson's ramshackle house, Belson wasn't there. Neither was the car. Mrs. Belson, a lady who looked road hard and put away still damp, told him the Acura had been stolen by her brother Howie. She gave him the address, which was also in Hillbilly Heaven.
"I got no love for Howie," she told Hodges, "but you might ought to get over before Jimmy kills him. When Jimmy's mad, he don't believe in talk. He goes right to beating."
When Hodges arrived, James Belson was indeed beating on Howie. He was doing this work with a rake handle, his bald head gleaming with sweat in the sunlight. Belson's brother-in-law was lying in his weedy driveway by the rear bumper of the Acura, kicking ineffectually at Belson and trying to shield his bleeding face and broken nose with his hands. Hodges stepped up behind Belson and soothed him with the happy slapper. The Acura was back on the car dealership's lot by noon, and Belson, the Bald Beater, was now up on assault.
"His lawyer is going to try to make you look like the bad guy," Holly says. "He's going to ask how you subdued Mr. Belson. You need to be ready for that, Bill."
"Oh, for goodness sake," Hodges says. "I thumped him one to keep him from killing his brother-in-law, that's all. Applied acceptable force and practiced restraint."
"But you used a weapon to do it. A sock loaded with ball bearings, to be exact."
"True, but Belson doesn't know that. His back was turned, and the other guy was semi-conscious at best."
"Okay."
But she looks worried, and her teeth are working at the spot she nipped while talking to Tina.
"I just don't want you to get in trouble. Promise me you'll keep your temper and not shout or wave your arms or—"
"Holly," he takes her by the shoulders, gently. "Go outside, smoke a cigarette, chillax. All will be well in court this morning and with Pete Saubers this afternoon."
She looks up at him wide-eyed. "Do you promise?"
"Yes."
"All right. I'll just smoke half a cigarette."
She heads for the door, rummaging in her bag.
"We are going to have such a busy day."
"I suppose we are. One other thing before you go." She turns back, questioning. "You should smile more often. You're beautiful when you smile." Holly, blushes all the way to her hairline, and hurries out. But she's smiling again, and that makes Hodges happy.
14. Morris is also having a busy day, and busy is good. As long as he's in motion, the doubts and fears don't have a chance to creep in. It helps that he woke up absolutely sure of one thing. This is the day he becomes a wolf, for real. He's all done patching up the Culture and Arts Center's outdated computer filing system so his fat fuck of a boss can look good to his boss. And he's done being Ellis McFarlane's pet lamb, too.
No more buying, yes, sir, and no, sir, and three bags full, sir, each time McFarlane shows up. Parole is finished. As soon as he has the Rothstein notebooks, he's getting the hell out of this piss pot of the city. He has no interest in going north to Canada, but that leaves the whole lower 48. He thinks maybe he'll opt for New England. Who knows? Maybe even New Hampshire. Reading the notebooks there, near the same mountains Rothstein must have looked at while he was writing, that had a certain novelistic roundness, didn't it? Yes, and that was the great thing about novels, that roundness, the way things always balanced out in the end. He should have known Rothstein couldn't leave Jimmy working for that fucking ad agency, because there was no roundness in that, just a big old scoop of ugly. Maybe, deep down in his heart, Morris had known it. Maybe it was what kept him sane all those years. He's never felt saner in his life. When he doesn't show up for work this morning, his fat fuck boss will probably call McFarlane. That, at least, is what he's supposed to do in the event of an unexplained absence. So Morris has to disappear, duck under the radar, go dark. Fine. Terrific, in fact. At 8 this morning, he takes the Main Street bus, rides all the way to its turnaround point where Lower Main ends, and then strolls down to Lacemaker Lane. Morris has put on his only sport coat and his only tie, and they're good enough for him to not look out of place here, even though it's too early for any of the fancy-schmancy stores to have opened. He turns down the alley between Andrew Halliday Rare Editions and the shop next door, La Bella Flora Children's Boutique. There are three parking spaces in the small courtyard behind the buildings, two for the clothing shop and one for the bookshop. There's a Volvo in one of the La Bella Flora spots. The other one is empty. So is the space reserved for Andrew Halliday. Also fine. Morris leaves the courtyard as briskly as he came, pauses for a comforting look at the closed sign hanging inside the bookshop door, and then strolls back to Lower Main, where he catches an uptown bus. Two changes later, he's stepping off in front of the Valley Plaza Shopping Center, just two blocks from the late Andrew Halliday's home. He walks briskly again, no strolling now, as if he knows where he is, where he's going, and has every right to be here. Coleridge Street is nearly deserted, which doesn't surprise him. It's 9:15. His fat fuck of a boss will by now be looking at Morris's unoccupied desk and fuming. The kids are in school. The work-a-daddies and work-a-mommies are off busting heavies to keep up with their credit card debt. Most delivery and service people won't start cruising the neighborhood until 10. The only better time would be the dozy hours of mid-afternoon, and he can't afford to wait that long. Too many places to go, too many things to do. This is Morris Bellamy's big day. His life has taken a long, long detour, but he's almost back on the main line. 15. Tina starts feeling sick around the time Morris is strolling up the late Drew Halliday's driveway and seeing his old pal's car parked inside his garage. Tina hardly slept at all last night because she's so worried about how Pete will take the news that she ratted him out. Her breakfast is sitting in her belly like a lump, and all at once, while Mrs. Sloan is performing Annabelle Lee, Mrs. Sloan never just reads. That lump of undigested food starts to crawl up her throat and toward the exit. She raises her hand. It seems to weigh at least 10 pounds, but she holds it up until Mrs. Sloan raises her eyes.
Yes, Tina? What is it?
She sounds annoyed, but Tina doesn't care. She's beyond caring. I feel sick. I need to go to the girls. Then go, by all means, but hurry back.
Tina scuttles from the room. Some of the girls are giggling. At 13, unscheduled bathroom visits are always amusing, but Tina is too concerned with that rising lump to feel embarrassed. Once in the hall, she breaks into a run, heading for the bathroom halfway down the hall as fast as she can. But the lump is faster, and she doubles over before she can get there and vomits her breakfast all over her sneakers. Mr. Haggerty, the school's head janitor, is just coming up the stairs. He sees her stagger backward from the steaming puddle of whoopsie and trots toward her, his tool belt jingling.
Hey, girl, you okay?
Tina gropes for the wall with an arm that feels made of plastic. The world is swimming. Part of that is because she has vomited hard enough to bring tears to her eyes, but not all. She wishes with all her heart that she hadn't let Barbara persuade her into talking to Mr. Hodges, that she had left Pete alone to work out whatever was wrong. What if he never speaks to her again? I'm fine, she says. I'm sorry I made him... But the swimming gets worse before she can finish. She doesn't exactly faint, but the world pulls away from her, becomes something she's looking at through a smudged window, rather than something she's actually in. She slides down the wall, amazed by the sight of her own knees, clad in green tights, coming up to meet her. That is when Mr. Haggerty scoops her up and carries her downstairs to the school nurse's office.
16. Andy's little green Subaru is perfect, as far as Morris is concerned, not apt to attract a first glance, let alone a second. There are only thousands just like it. He backs down the driveway and sets off for the north side, keeping an eye out for cops and obeying every speed limit. At first, it's almost a replay of Friday night. He stops once more at the Bellows Avenue Mall and once more visits Home Depot. He goes to the tools section, where he picks out a screwdriver with a long blade and a chisel. Then he drives on to the square brick hulk that used to be the Birch Street Recreation Center and once more parks in the space marked Reserved for Rec Department Vehicles. It's a good spot in which to do dirty business. There's a loading dock on one side and a high hedge on the other. He's visible only from behind, the baseball field and crumbling basketball courts. But with school in session, those areas are deserted. Morris goes to the basement window he noticed before, squats, and rams the blade of his screwdriver into the crack at the top. It goes in easily because the wood is rotten. He uses the chisel to widen the crack. The glass rattles in its frame but doesn't break because the putty is old and there's plenty of give. The possibility that this hulk of a building has alarm protection is looking slimmer all the time. Morris swaps the chisel for the screwdriver again. He chivvies it through the gap he's made, catches the thumb lock, and pushes. He looks around to make sure he's still unobserved. It's a good spot, yes, but breaking and entering in broad daylight is still a scary proposition, and sees nothing but a crow perched on a telephone pole. He inserts the chisel at the bottom of the window, beating it in as deep as it will go with the heel of his hand, then bears down on it. For a moment, there's nothing. Then the window slides up with a squall of wood and a shower of dirt. Bingo. He wipes sweat from his face as he peers in at the stored chairs, card tables, and boxes of junk, verifying that it will be easy to slide in and drop to the floor. But not quite yet. Not while there's the slightest possibility that a silent alarm is lighting up somewhere. Morris takes his tools back to the little green Subaru and drives away.
17. Linda Saubers is monitoring the mid-morning activity period at Northfield Elementary School when Peggy Moran comes in and tells her that her daughter has been taken sick at Dorton Middle some 3 miles away.
She's in the nurse's office, Peggy says, keeping her voice low. I understand she vomited and then sort of passed out for a few minutes.
Oh, my God. Linda says. She looked pale at breakfast, but when I asked her if she was okay, she said she was.
That's the way they are, Peggy says, rolling her eyes.
It's either melodrama or I'm fine, Mom, get a life.
Go get her and take her home. I'll cover this, and Mr. Jablonski has already called a sub.
You're a saint. Linda is gathering up her books and putting them into her briefcase.
It's probably a stomach thing,
Peggy says, sliding into the seat Linda has just vacated.
I guess you could take her to the nearest dock in the box, but why bother spending $30? That stuff's going around.
I know, Linda says, but she wonders. She and Tom have been slowly but surely digging themselves out of two pits, a money pit and a marriage pit. The year after Tom's accident, they came perilously close to breaking up. Then the mystery cash started coming, a kind of miracle, and things started to turn around. They aren't all the way out of either hole even yet, but Linda has come to believe they will get out.
With their parents focused on brute survival, and Tom, of course, had the additional challenge of recovering from his injuries, the kids have spent far too much time flying on autopilot. It's only now, when she feels she finally has room to breathe and time to look around her, that Linda clearly senses something not right with Pete and Tina.
They're good kids, smart kids, and she doesn't think either of them has gotten caught in the usual teenage traps. Drink, drugs, shoplifting, sex. But there's something, and she supposes she knows what it is.
She has an idea Tom does, too.
God sent manna from heaven when the Israelites were starving, but cash drops from more prosaic sources, banks, friends, an inheritance, relatives who are in a position to help out. The mystery money didn't come from any of those sources, certainly not from relatives. Back in 2010, all their kinfolk were just as strapped as Tom and Linda themselves. Only kids are relatives too, aren't they? It's easy to overlook that because they're so close, but they are. It's absurd to think the cash came from Tina, who'd only been 9 years old when the envelope started arriving, and who couldn't have kept a secret like that anyway. Pete, though, he's the close-mouthed one. Linda remembers her mother saying when Pete was only 5, that one's got a lock on his lips. Only where could a kid of 13 have come by that kind of money? As she drives to Dorton Middle to pick up her ailing daughter, Linda thinks, we never asked any questions, not really, because we were afraid to. No one who didn't go through those terrible months after Tommy's accident could get that, and I'm not going to apologize for it. We had reasons to be cowardly, plenty of them. The two biggest were living right under our roof and counting on us to support them. But it's time to ask who was supporting whom. If it was Pete, if Tina found out, and that's what's troubling her, I need to stop being a coward. I need to open my eyes. I need some answers.